You know what they're going to do, that you know what they stand for, you know what their ideology is. The problem is the right of politics, if you like, which doesn't exist because they've all cuddled up with the left. The right represents freedom, it's meant to anyway, and it doesn't exist. And because everyone's being so nice, and we, in that way, we kind of deserve to die, because next year is going to be the most horrific year in human history, and people aren't prepared to believe it, because they're determined to look at the world through the eyes of a decent person, as Sev Salenko says. You're looking at the world through the eyes of a decent person. You can't do that when you've got communist murderers on the other side. You can't do that. You've got to look at it like they look at it. They're evil. Everything they do and everything they say backs that up. And if we can't see that, you know, we are all dead. That's how I see it. You know, this requires a very strong, dare I say it, masculine response. They have to step up. The men have to step up at times like this and be men and stop being wussy about it, because that's what we're being at the moment, and that's why we're going to die, and our children are going to die. If we put up wussiness against communist, or whatever you call it, globalist, communist, technocracy, whatever, fascist, it doesn't matter about the word, they're evil.
Hi, this is Grant Edwards for Liberty NZ and Countersman Media. With me is my good friend Dennis Hall. Hello, Dennis.
G'day, Grant. How you doing?
Very well, my friend. You sound very good. You're feeling a lot better after that hospital visit?
Yeah, my voice comes and goes a bit, but I'm sort of slowly getting there.
You're doing very well, mate.
My body doesn't know how to do all that stuff properly.
You're doing great, eh? Now, you rang me earlier and asked me what was my opinion on the, in one sentence, what my opinion of the Catholic Church is, and I said, well, what do you think of the Catholic Church, I think you said, and I said, well, the Catholic Church, the Church is the people, and I love the Catholic people, didn't I?
Mm-hmm. And you did? And
I
so,
did.
But, you know, I was raised a Catholic.
Yeah.
And I was one of those very bloody attentive children who listened, hung on every word the nun said, because I was so surprised that people were telling me that stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's all in there. You know, I can't get, none of it goes away. And it's all in the brain.
Well,
and every now and again, they play with it. And so today,
they get into your head, don't they, these nuns?
The nuns? Well, yeah, you know, they were sweet old things, most of them.
Yeah.
Some of them were pretty evil with a ruler over the back of the knuckles. But
I've heard about these stories.
But, you know, people always sort of infer there's a sexual nature to a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I've done that a little bit here.
Yeah.
And whatever. But, you know, to be fair, I never saw any sexual behaviour from nuns, brothers, or priests ever. I only saw one thing that was slightly dodgy, and that was when a brother came down the stairs into the dressing rooms at Marist Newdown, picked up one of the kids who had his togs off, and ran around in circles slapping him on the ass.
Well, that's a bit
weird.
But
apart from that,
that's a bit dodgy.
Well,
isn't
it's
it?
A bit weird. And we all thought so too. He had a rigid attention. It's probably the wrong place to use the word rigid.
Uh-huh.
But so you know, I'm not accusing Catholics or brothers or nuns or anything, because I never saw anything like that. But
they were
what
good
they
to you.
Did is they? Eh?
They were good to you.
Well, yeah, they were all right.
Yeah.
And so you know, they used to like me because I used to make little statues of Mary and Joseph. And Jesus, you know, had a pastor's thing. I've always been able to make stuff, you know, like very accurate statues. You've seen them.
Yes. Wonderful work.
So I used to keep them at bay by doing that.
Very talented sculptor.
I'm going to lose my thread from time to time because my memory is shattered.
All right, well,
so
that's understandable.
This whole thing that I've got here is actually addressed to the New York Times.
Okay.
And I'm still deciding whether, the reason I called you about it, Grant, you need to know, was I was going to ask your advice about whether I should send it.
My advice? Well, let's hear it.
Well, what I'm not, it. I mean, You could be the voice of common sense, because I'm a lunatic.
Oh, well, I think I'm a lunatic too from time to time. Moonstruck.
We'll see what... Look, we can interrupt each other while I do this, okay?
No, I'll be quiet. I'll be quiet and you read it. Yep, you just read it and I'll be quiet.
No, you can interrupt me whenever you like. It'll be a break for my voice. Now, I can see you at the moment on the screen, but I'm going to push this Word file up in front of you so I can't see you anymore, but I can read it out, okay? So here it is. And so this is a letter addressed to the New York Times. So I said, g'day there from New Zealand. I sure hope you are well. You know, you've got to be nice to these people, don't you? And so I said, this is a pitch to get a book reviewed. I know you're busy, and there are two ways that I could do this, quite short, blunt, and to the point, or longish, and a little bit more entertaining. So 6 pages altogether, and I was writing small. Please try to treat this as an interesting diversion. It is a pitch to get me... Oh, no.
Oh, there we go. So while Dennis is going to... are you going to take that call or what?
I have to, yeah.
Yeah, hello? Take that call. Yeah. And in the meantime, let's have a look at New Zealand Centre for Political Research. Dennis, can you mute yourself? No, you can't.
Oh, look, we haven't got the lockbox back yet.
So in the meantime, we've got the New Zealand Centre for Political Research here, and Dennis has often been asked to contribute to the New Zealand Centre for Political Research. That's run by Muriel Newman. Muriel Newman was a former politician. I think she was with the... Was it the National Party or the ACT Party? I'll have to ask Dennis when he gets off his call. He hasn't learned how to mute the calls. I'm going to have to teach him, but that's okay. That's okay.
Sorry about that.
No, not a problem. Now, what I'll do is I'll teach you how to mute your microphone. So in the middle of your Skype there, you've got... I'll just get us back on the screen. So Dennis, in the middle of your Skype
there's just there.
Yeah, there's a microphone. So when you get a call and you got to take it, and then I can just ad lib, you see, and then you just hit that one there, and then I don't hear your phone call. And also, we're going out on Twitch TV, and so they'll all be listening to you talking about the lockbox. So, are you selling properties? Because you're involved. Your wife's son is a very clever man. He's not only a computer expert, but he's also a bit of a property developer or trader of properties. Oh, he sounds very
Jack,
clever.
Yeah. Jack is just a clever bugger, all right.
Yeah.
Lily and I are just pensioners, you know. And so the lockbox was for my medical arm, which I don't wear.
Oh, I thought it was the lockbox. When they say lockbox, they talk about real estate, don't they?
but this is so that if I had a turn in the middle of the night and I pressed the button, the ambulance would get in.
And so if it's in a lockbox, how do you get to it?
Well, they can open it because they have a key to it.
When they arrive?
The ambulance do, yeah.
Right, and what's in the lockbox?
Well, the ambulance, the key to the house.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, just like the real estate ones. Yep, I got you. Now I got you.
Press the button. Along comes the ambulance, can't get in the house because I'm stuffed.
Like, say Lily's fast asleep, and you've pushed the button, you don't want to wake her, you're having a turn. They come, the ambulance arrives, goes to the lockbox, comes straight in, puts you in the ambulance and off to the hospital, resuscitates you, and Lily wakes up in the morning and you're back in bed again.
Orwell. Orwellian.
Orwell.
Did you say Orwell?
Orwell.
All right, so shall I go back to this?
Yeah, no, just carry on. Sounds interesting. So you've written the letter, you've done an introduction, you could start on whenever you like. Brilliant.
Yeah, so where do I get up to?
I don't know.
I want to encourage you to review my book that I've written.
That's it.
That I can assure you will be like no other book you've ever read. I say that and I mean it. It is completely different. I read all the time. In certain circles that will cause outrage, indignation, and fury. Blasphemous, sacrilegious, sinful, and disrespectful. And here's my summary in 139 words, right? It is unique in style and content and is called A Well-Intentioned Sinner. A Well-Intentioned Sinner. Here it is. And so, unfortunately, a very fat book.
That's your book, isn't it?
Yep. And I only had 25 copies printed and they went...
Wasn't that 900 pages?
It might be 900 pages. It's
that's quite a volume.
Exactly. 700 pages.
Well, that's almost three. That's almost three books in one. A lot of books. A lot of books are only, you know, look, at least over two books. A lot of books are only 300 words, aren't they? So that's good. Anyway, I digress. A well-intentioned sinner. You're writing to the New York Times?
Yeah.
Right.
And it's published on Amazon as an e-book. It is too long, I've said, as in it's a saga.
Mm.
And it is about an ancient order of nuns. Mm. I've said here, good nuns, you know, really, why? Individually, they are Magdalites, and collectively, they are the Magdalenum. And they all carry the bloodline of Christ. Here we talk about the implications of that in the modern age and what they have to do to keep it secret, alive, recorded in detail, and projected into the future. It contains some of what I would call historical and thoughtful fiction and erotica. Perhaps that will scare you off, but I cannot tell a lie and I and not mention it. Thoughtful erotica means thoughtful. It doesn't mean tits and bums. Here is a link for a free copy, and so there's a link there. Now I'm saying, going back and referring to that and saying, that was the short version. The long version begins here. You can read on and get to know me a little, or plead time constraints and not bother with the flagrant flippancy to come. But I do have quite a long and unusual little story to tell you that could become an interesting article or story for you and your publication. And if you do read it, I can assure you, you'll not forget me.
Mm.
I say things that people just don't say. I mean, there's no swear words or anything like that. Anyway, so I've said here, you choose.
No swear words. That's not like you, is it?
No, I swear a lot, but I know.
No,
I'm very careful not to swear anymore.
Yes, very good. No swearing and no silence. On radio, silence and swearing are out.
Okay, good. So I want to tell you about this saga, which is called A Well-Intentioned Sinner, was created out of the sexualization of my childhood person at the hands of Catholic nuns in 1946 to 1951. And no, I have no intention of seeking either absolution or retribution. The nuns never laid a finger on me except to bash the back of my hand with a ruler. So, you know, I'm not suggesting they did anything like that. It was just what they put in my head.
Mm.
So, anyway, back to what I've written here. My religious education started the first day I walked into that Catholic school classroom on the first day of age 5. That was halfway through the school year because I was born in June. I thought for a while that I might have missed the best part for being 6 months late. This is about the mind space where my book came from. And that does feature speculation around religious erotica as taught to us in school by inference. It was influenced by, so that's inference, and then I go on to say it was influenced, it's a bit close together for two similar words, I was influenced by Catholic law as it existed and it was taught in the schools in the 40s and the 50s and beyond. They talked endlessly about chastity, virginity, impure thoughts, adultery, and coveting the neighbor's wife. And I talk about what that knowledge of those things might have done to this curious child's mind. Now, you know, I'm just going to add this in. The thing about those words and the sins that they talked about were that they were just words to us. You know, we didn't know what they meant. Do you know what I mean? And so the poor nuns with a nasty little bugger like me in the classroom, I said, buggers, okay. And the thing is that, yeah, but if I, not to flash, but if you are, you know, I mean, you ask them questions that are difficult to answer, and I didn't know they were difficult to answer. So I have to own up, and I'm reading again, I have to own up and tell you that now as an adult, as in a couple of years, as in a couple of years ago, I sat down and I wrote this 700-page book inspired by my Catholic education. It was inspired by all that above, but not actually about it. It is more about what it did to my artistic imagination. A well-intentioned sinner, that was me. It was influenced by those nuns of my childhood, and almost inadvertently they gave me this saga, The Well-Intentioned Sinner. It actually describes the intellectual and sexual and religious conspiracy of the Magdalenum, a highly secret and worldwide order of fabulously wealthy and very well-connected nuns who somehow emerged straight out of my amazing religious and sexual imagination that was nurtured in that Catholic school in the 40s. So the Magdalenum and the Magdalites, who are the nuns, were completely the product of my imagination. They're not real. These ladies that I call Magdalites, the ones of my imagination, and since they were nuns, I call them ladies advisedly. I'm not sure why I said that, but I did. Whereas individually, they, my nuns, do call themselves Magdalites because of their blood connection to Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ. As a result of that blood connection, they have and preserve and protect the sacred bloodline of Jesus Christ all the way from a decision their predecessors made at the Council of Nicaea in the year 353. And we examine the results of that now in the early 20th century. Now, I'm going to stop reading again because I want to say this about that. I believe that this all came out of the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is a big fat book, just fatter than my one. And in it, and the only author's name I can remember is Bajant.
Yes, Michael Bajant and Richard Lee. I read the book in around about 1990.
Right. And the proposition that they put forward was that, and they based it on the fact that Jesus Christ was able to go into the temple and drive out the moneylenders, right? And they sort of said that to be able to go into the temple meant that they had to be Jews, and that he had to be a Jew and a rabbi. Right? And as such, as a rabbi, because he was a Jew, Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, he was a Jew. You know, there is no doubt about
that. That's correct. Only a Jew would be allowed into the temple.
That's right. And Christianity emerged out of Judaism. Just it. And Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, they called him that because he was a Jew. Right. So he goes into the temple and drives these people out, so that sort of proves that. But also, as a rabbi, he was expected to be married.
Oh, was
and
he?
Who would he be married to?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, rabbis were expected to be married. And have children. So the thing was that he was had to be married to Mary Magdalene. Now, the thing about that is when I was a kid...
Could I stop you there on that point? That he had to be married. Well, the fact that he wasn't married, but it was still a good idea for him to be married, or for people to be married that are in the church, for rabbis, because look what happened in the Catholic Church with the unmarried priests.
Oh, well, yeah, not being married sort of opens a man to all kinds of temptations and things, I would say.
Yes. Well, you could say that if you take the natural away from a man, he may lean towards the unnatural.
Well, yeah,
I think that's why it's important to be married, especially if you're in a religion.
So we've gone off on a tangent.
Not really. We need to I'm just making a point on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so the thing about this is that you have to remember, Grant, that my brain is a little bit linear. You know,
you're doing really well. Look, you've been through a lot.
If I get tipped off it.
You've had heart failure. Well, you've got heart failure, so you're doing extremely well, Dennis.
You're very kind.
And I'll try not to interrupt, because I can see that it doesn't help.
Oh, I don't mind you interrupting when I'm reading, but interrupting thoughts is a different thing because it's hard to get them back.
Well, look, I'll just recap for you. The nuns carry the bloodline of Christ. You went to school from 6 years old to 11 years old, taught by the nuns, and then there's a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, written by Michael Bajant and Richard Lee, round about the late 80s, early 90s. Dan Brown, it looked as though he'd plagiarised that work, but he managed to get off that. And you believe, and I think it's rightly so, that Jesus was a Jew, and that only a Jew could enter into the temple. And he went into the temple there because they weren't doing what he felt they should be doing. They were actually trading, buying and selling in the temple, which he said belonged to his father. And so he chased them all out, tipped the tables over and chased them all out. And we're talking about your book called a well-intentioned sinner, when you've got a similar line with the Magdalene.
Right, right. So the business of there's something else that comes out of that, and that is about
we can't see you, Dennis.
No, well, you know what I was doing was I was doing something off the top of my head about the business of early Christianity and Jesus Christ and whatever, and the diversion just exploded all out in my head. Oh, look, I'll just go back to
just read to, what you read your thesis. Yeah,
yeah. Mm. So these ladies, these ladies that I called the Magdalites, the ones of my imagination, and since they were nuns, I call them ladies advisedly, whereas that's just me being sarcastic, where individually they, my nuns, do call themselves Magdalites, because they're in the Magdalenium. And because of their blood connection to Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ, as a result of that blood connection, they have and preserve and protect the sacred bloodline of Jesus Christ all the way from the decision by their, I read that, predecessors made at the Council of Nicaea, which was a real thing in the year 353 when Christianity got a lot of its, established a lot of its dogma. And we examine the results of that now in the early 20th, 21st century. So I've gone, yes, it is what it is. And by strange journeys of my warped imagination, and of course it was only me that knew all that, because I made it up. So it was me that had to write it all down, right? Which is what I've done, and made that great big fat book. Imagine an entire worldwide secret society of nuns looking to secretly get pregnant so they can preserve the sacred bloodline of Jesus Christ. You know, the thing I think I was going to say before about that is that if what Lee and Bajant prophesied, but that's not what they did, speculated on, was that Jesus Christ got married and had children. When you sit down and think about what that means, if that, you know, that being 2,000 years ago, and they had children and they went on to propagate and have more children, you could almost say that most of the people alive in the world today would carry the bloodline of Jesus Christ.
Well, it would be incredible, because if it was true, if he sired children with Mary Magdalene, so in other words, but I thought he died on the cross.
But you, that was the thing I was going to say before. Mm. When I was being taught by the nuns, they told us that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute.
Which I believe is true. According to the Bible, she was a prostitute.
According to the Bible, she was.
According to the Bible, she was a devil possessed with, I think, at least seven devils, demon devils, and she was a prostitute, as far as I know. She was a,
Oh, well, so she found a new. Well, it just seemed to me at the time, I didn't know what a prostitute
was. But she
was.
Repented of all that, and Christ forgave her, because apparently he has the ability to forgive, because he is God in human form, the Bible says.
Right. Complicated, eh? So anyway, but I think that my idea about these nuns having children to preserve the bloodline is a new idea. I've said that now. That really is a new idea.
Mm.
That's why I think my book should be famous.
But the thing is, what's different? Your book. Why is your book any different? Like, when did you write your book?
Oh, look, I copied it. I didn't copy it. It was absolutely influenced by, as I've said before, Holy Grail.
I forgot to mention Henry Lincoln. He is also one of the authors in that book. I always forget him.
Yeah, right. Henry Lincoln. Well, yeah. You've got a better memory than me. Everybody's got a better memory than me.
Because it had a profound effect on me. I thought, well, if this is true, then Christianity's a load of nonsense. Christ didn't die on the cross. He couldn't have died for the sins of the world. He couldn't raise from the dead. He wasn't who he said he was. He was a liar, if it was true. Or he was deluded.
That's a whole other subject that I haven't even thought about.
Yeah, okay. But that's the key. That's what it says in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that if it's true, it's going to just shatter all of Christianity, if it's true.
Right. Well,
but I think there is a good argument against it. But anyway, let's finish your book.
But this, I don't want to destroy Christianity with what I'm saying here.
Well, that book does. If Jesus and Mary Magdalene became husband and wife and had children, sired children, and those children, the bloodline of those children, are alive today, then there is no Christianity. Christianity is a waste of time. You know, might as well go out and just forget about it. Chuck the Bible out and eat, drink, and be merry, because it's all baloney.
Don't spoil my story.
Okay.
So where was I up to? So I've said yes, the bloodline.
I can't help it, can I?
No,
I
just, mucking about.
I just have to interrupt. Sorry.
Sorry.
I have to interrupt. I'm awfully sorry. You keep going. I'll just shut up. I'll mute myself now.
Yeah. Well, you know, these ladies know what they want and they know what they need and they go out and get it. So some readers will cope with this story and some won't, and some will want to send me to hell. And Lily just came in and gave me some eggs. Thank you, Lily.
Hello.
Hello.
You can't see me.
Yeah, just give. Wait.
I'm talking.
Just give him a little wave.
Lily, you're a lovely person, and I think Dennis is so lucky to have you, because you're doing a fabulous job looking after him.
Yeah,
she's amazing,
and he adores you. It's wonderful.
Mm.
I'm jealous.
Thank you.
I'm jealous of the relation of your marriage. It's fantastic.
Every man and woman need
to be in a relationship like that.
And she just bought me some eggs. Look.
Oh, eggs! Are they still? Oh, my chook stopped laying, but that's another story.
No, we got them from the supermarket. Okay. Our chooks are down at the New World.
Okay, you guys.
Bye, bye, Lily. Great to meet you.
Bye, bye, Lily.
Yeah.
Where do we get up to? Some readers will
cope. Jesus and Mary Magdalene, husband and wife.
Yep. Some readers will cope, and some won't, and some will want to send me to hell. But I know everything about them, these nuns, because I made them up. They are very naughty nuns, and I'm prepared to discuss that in any context. I'm saying, well, I am. Because I do try to actually talk to the reader, you know, involve the reader.
Yeah.
Address the reader all the time. So is there also this book that I've already mentioned, The Well-Intentioned Sinner? There it is again, in case you forgot already. And since I finished writing it, I've figured out where in my head this sacrilegious saga that I'm guilty of writing actually came from. And you, the newspaper person and potential reader, because remember, this is supposed to be going to the New York Times or the Boston Globe for your own protection from religious subversion at the hands of this particular lunatic author, probably need to know the following. It was me that thought all this up, all of it. It slithered out of the murky darkness at the back of my brain, followed by a phalanx of nuns and brothers. Have I already read this book? And priests and cardinals and some very dodgy women in the 20th century, following all kinds of centuries-old ecclesiastical rules and laws, and into the page of my book, splat. And it became the Well-Intentioned Sinner. And there's that I put a copy of, I must have read this before. But in defense of myself, and my flippant attitude to the self-promotional letter, I was actually prompted to write this blasphemy of a book and the blasphemy of this letter by some 75-year-old residual brain activity caused by the relentless religious and mental secularization I received from those nuns when I was 5, 6, 7, and 8 years old, not even to consider what it did to my puberty. Give them the child and they'll give you the man, they said, or especially the teenage boy learning about the opposite sex, or women for that matter. When I sat there in that class, my 5-year-old self, helplessly in the clutches and total control of dear little sister Rose, I was all ears, because I was amazed by the astonishing stuff she was telling us about God and his son Jesus and the Virgin Mary. And I worried a lot about what I had missed in all those first 6 months because I didn't know then what a virgin was. So I made sure I asked a lot of questions so I could catch up. How are we doing? It was the sexual vocabulary that got to me first, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that was what it was. And I had to ask questions about all of it, because I was one of those pain-in-the-ass curious kids who was trying to catch up. Right from the get-go, lovely little sister Rose talked about the Virgin Mary and the virgins and virginity and all things virginal a lot. Like there were virgins everywhere, and everywhere a person might look. But I'd never knowingly seen one till Sister Rose. Yes, Sister Rose. She told us she was a virgin and talked about this whole virgin thing all the time and losing it or keeping it and how it was valuable and very, very important not to lose it and how girls would be damned if they lost it and where or when or how they were likely to lose it was not really even covered. So bit by bit, I figured out that a person, mostly female, could be an actual virgin, and virginity was also a state of being that a person, mainly a woman, and especially a nun, could be in, and if they lost it, it was gone forever. And they might go to hell and be tormented by fallen angels and devils who apparently would be able to tell immediately that such a person wasn't a virgin. Forever. There were a lot of people who apparently lost it forever, but hopefully none of them were actual nuns. I'm just putting in a plug for the nuns. At the same time, they talked about making a vow of chastity and being chaste. C-H-A-S-E-D, because that's the way I interpreted chaste. And that seemed to me, and so this paragraph will be a bit confusing, and that seemed to me to be a bit the same as being a virgin. But I do think I knew that it was all definitely connected. The chaste part of that confused me at first, because if they were being chaste, did they have to let themselves be caught? Or did that mean they would lose their virginity? And that was yet another way to look at this series of conundrum in my child's mind. I wondered how I would be able to tell from where I sat in that classroom if an actual virgin were to walk into the room. Would they be like Sister Rose and wear long black robes and a white thing around their head and rosary beads hanging on the ominous leather belt? And would they always tell me they were a virgin? And that virginity and being chaste, I knew not where, was their state of being, or was that a personal thing? Unless you were a nun, in which case, apparently, everyone needed to know you were a virgin and that you were being chaste. C-H-A-E-D. In the classroom, hands up, Sister Rose. Yes, Dennis. We are all happy that you're a virgin, sister. But what is a virgin, sister? The answer was unintelligible and just made me even more curious. Much to my mother's chagrin, I came home from school obsessed with virgins and virginity. I asked my mum if she was a virgin, and she circled around me a bit, but she never actually hit me. For all that, I could tell nuns were different because they wore strange clothes and could be strict and always carried a punishment implement that they were allowed to punish me with. And everyone was polite to them, and whenever they got angry or nervous, they would rattle their rosary beads. And I also knew there was a set of those at home, and I was told I would get one of my own soon. Seemed a bit girly to me, really. Beads. Someone religious thought I needed beads. I would have to hide them from the boys or they would give me shit for sure. Sorry about that. You, dear reader, can tell I'm just indulging myself now. And see, this is me addressing the reader. I'm just having a bit of fun, you know. You can tell I'm just indulging myself now, I've said. All that religious instruction followed with the Virgin Mary, and she was the Mother of God. And now God has a mother? God has a mother? And we have to wonder if she's a virgin now as well? And then Sister Rose has gone on to assure us how she herself and all her fellow nuns were virgins too, just like the Virgin Mary, doing virginal things and doing the work of Christ and God, who were kind of one and the same. They were one and the same, and not really, because now he had a mother. So maybe, after all, he wasn't the first. And, of course, she told us that he was the Son of God, as well as being God, and that there was only one God while she was busy telling us about two of them. More confusion for us kids. And Mary, Holy Mary, Mother of God, they called her, the Virgin Mary, was his mother, like, you know, Jesus' mother. And he is the Son of God. So, obviously, she was the Mother of God. And that dude she was with, you know, Joseph, he wasn't actually Jesus' father at all, because Jesus was a virgin birth. I still haven't figured out what the deal was with that Joseph dude, and I haven't. But on the positive side, right then, I knew that all this virgin business had something to do with birth. And I knew that I had already been there and done that even if I couldn't remember it, because I'd got born. And I did know who my mother was because she told me that she was my mother. But I hadn't figured out how she did all that. And when I asked her if I was a virgin birth, she flew off the handle again and asked me where I got that idea from. And I said, from Sister Rose. And she left the room and slammed the door. I could tell she wasn't happy. And right there were other questions. All this was very confusing, even though I still don't know what a virgin, I still didn't know what a virgin actually was. Because I needed to understand the impact of being a virgin had on the story of God. Because I think I could tell it was all connected in some way. And then there were more religious vocabulary to deal with. There were impure thoughts. Impure thoughts. I was interested in those. Well, you would be, wouldn't you? And I wondered if they would dirty up my brain, which was where I thought, where I knew thoughts happened. I knew thoughts happened in my brain, even though I was a little kid. And apparently, because you can feel them, eh? And apparently some of them could get out of control and slither down into your pants. That's what it seemed like to me. That part was obviously a boy's problem, but virginity was for sure a girl's problem. How are we doing, Grant?
We're doing all right. What age were you when you were being taught this?
Well, I'm talking about when I was 5, 6, and 7.
Well, you were born in 1940. You went to school in 1946 to 1951 at this convent school. So you would have been between 6 and 11, somewhere around there.
Yeah, no, I would have been under 11. Mm. But, you know, because of the conditioning changed. But I did question it, and I know I questioned it in the ways that I'm describing here.
Yeah.
So then they told me I could wash away the impure thoughts by going to confection.
Confection?
You know, I didn't get confection. I didn't get it.
Is that like where you get confectionery?
Yeah, in that box thing at the side of the church. And I wondered if that involved eating sweets or soap and water.
Yeah.
Eating sweets or soap and water in that little confectional box. But I was still 2 years too young to go in there because to do that you needed to be 7.
Oh, so you must have only been 6.
Eh?
You must have been 6 years old.
Yeah, well, I wasn't, but I wasn't. So you're not allowed to go to confession until you're 7.
It seems young to be teaching you all this. I would have thought they would have been teaching you lovely Old Testament Bible stories about David and Goliath and Daniel in the lion's den and Joseph's technicolor coat and leaving all this stuff alone. Seems a bit weird.
No, they did all that, Joseph and technicolor dream coat as well.
Anyway, you were 6 years old and they were telling you about, you were finding out about the confectionery.
And if I died in the meantime with impure thoughts in my brain, that I might, which I didn't know how to recognise, that I might go to hell and burn forever and ever. Amen. And anyway, I really had thought she had said confectional box.
Confectional.
Because I already knew what confections meant and I was up for that. But then she told me I was still too young to go in there because I needed to be 7 for that in the confectional box. Confessions now. So that's when I've, you know, got the idea that it was confessions. And I was going to have to tell the dude in the box impure thoughts. And that took a bit of figuring out. And I soon was becoming even more convinced that all of this had something to do with what girls kept in their pants. You know, you just get the message. You do get the message. It's sort of, it's almost subliminal, but you get the message. I knew I needed to investigate that. I had lived a bit there. I also used to notice in the church, and I don't really want to mention it here, but I'm going to, there was always quite a lot of sad and lonely looking ladies, older than my mum, all waiting there to go to confession, but not kneeling next to each other. They sort of knelt, you know, stayed apart, and they didn't look like sinners to me. And I wondered about what they would have in their heads to secretly whisper in the priest's ear in that confessional box. I wondered if they would talk about virginity. Mm. Maybe they were sad because they'd lost theirs somewhere. For a while, I wondered if there were lost virginities lying about all over the place. And I wondered why I'd never seen one. And, you know, I mean, it's kids. You know, I don't know why I remember all this crap, but I do. And the confessional, I thought that maybe that was the only intimacy those sad and lonely ladies ever got. You know, I did actually consider that. I wondered if their husbands knew that they were there doing that, whispering secrets to a dude in a box. Whispering secrets to a dude in a box. Well, maybe they didn't have husbands. Would that be because husbands needed wives who still had virginity? You know, it was a question that sort of... Then there was Sister Rose, eager as ever, busy telling us about the Ten Commandments and adultery and how thou shalt not commit it. I wondered if I could possibly be guilty of committing that when I was not even seven. I didn't even know what it was. I really was worried that I might inadvertently commit it and go to hell forever and ever, amen, with the sin of adultery being burned off my soul forever. So, you know, I tell you what, Grant, when you get that full-on religious education as a child, a lot of it raises a lot of weird questions in your head.
It seems awfully young, six years old, to be talking about these themes.
Oh, yeah, they were into it big time, mate.
Mm.
Then there was coveting my neighbour's wife that I shall not do.
They talked about that when you were six.
Well, they were doing the Ten Commandments. The first thing they did when we got to school was the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife.
But I mean,
you know, they read them all out.
I just don't think that's appropriate. For a six-year-old, look, I mean, I think you'd sort of wait until the child came to you and said, you know, I was reading the Bible. What does it mean here when it says, what does covet mean?
Now, we could, Grant, when we were 6 years old at school, we could recite all Ten Commandments.
Wow. We just could. And you knew what they meant? You knew what you were reading at six?
No, you had no idea what. No. Well, no. You knew what, thou shalt not kill, and thou shalt not, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery. We had no idea what adultery was.
No.
Good God. And so,
probably that's a good thing. That's probably why the Bible's written that way, because so that it doesn't pollute a child. So I just don't think you'd take a child there. I think you should do Jesus's teaching. You just do to others what you'd like them to do unto you, because that involves everything, the whole Ten Commandments. Just be kind to others as you'd like them to treat others the way you want them to treat you. And I think it's all in one, isn't it? In that little sentence, that would be better for a six-year-old, don't you think?
Well, who knows? I think that now they must have modified it. Surely they don't do all this. Let me finish. How can I covet the neighbor's wife, sister? I asked. Maybe she thought I was looking for some how-to instructions. Nearly finished. Then there is that big commandment that says, thou shalt not have other gods before me. And that seemed contradiction when Sister Rose was flat out telling us that there was only one God anyway. So where would they get another one to put before the main one? So, Mr. Newspaper Person, I'm addressing the New York Times again. I have to confess that this brain that wrote you this letter of explanation became an adult 60 years ago. And 5 years ago, I wrote a 700-page book that was influenced by such things. And it was, you know, and how all that could be subverted by an order of nuns all desperate and determined to shed virginity and get pregnant and send that sacred bloodline off into the far future all the way from that far past. So those sort of key words were chastity, virginity, impure thoughts, adultery, humiliation, whipping, crown of thorns, crucifixion, and torture. You know, they talked to us about all of that before we were seven, well and truly. These words were all my first religious words. Do we think I need therapy? I've said it. Do we think I need therapy? Well, after this, maybe I do. Do you read my letter out loud to the whole office yet? So this is what I'm saying to the newspaper guy. Did you read my letter out loud to the whole office yet?
Mm-hmm.
Will someone please review my flaming book? Best regards to all, Dennis Hall, desperate author. All that above was absolutely nothing to do with my book. It was just me being entirely self-indulgent because I love writing. And sisters used to warn us about being self-indulgent.
Right. So that's the whole theme of it, self-indulgent. We're speaking with Dennis Hall. He's the author of A Well-Intentioned Sinner. Did you write this book about 20 years ago?
20?
Or 10 years ago?
No, I finished it about four years ago.
Oh, okay. How long did it take you to write it?
What I did is I wrote it, because I'm very naughty, I wrote the gist, which was about nuns and the bloodline of Christ and them propagating the bloodline by devising ways of getting pregnant and then hiding the children in an orphan getting rid of the boys and keeping the girls. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, they don't trust the bloodline unless it comes through the female line. Because, you know, a guy can never guarantee he's the father of a child without a DNA test, if you know what I mean. Mm. But a woman, I mean, a woman pops it out from between her legs, she's definitely the mother.
She knows it's hers, so, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's the way that is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, all of that stuff used to run around in my head as a kid. I just kind of thought, and so when I read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and which I read a few years before I read the Da Vinci Code, and I read Holy Blood, Holy Grail and thought, you know, this touches on a lot of the stuff that I believed and wondered about when I was a little kid.
Mm.
Because, you know, once I'd left school and once I was no longer a virgin myself and once I sort of realised what you could and couldn't do, you know, I've always been a person to avoid trouble. I've never been a person to commit crimes. And I respect women and whatever. And you know, I respect other people's religions as well. So that makes me a little bit concerned about what I've done here, because in a way it's disrespecting the religion. But it's
well, you know, if the Bible's true, it's more than that. Yeah, I wouldn't be concerned about other people. I'd be more concerned about if you've blasphemed and upset or displeased the God of heaven and earth. I'd be more worried about that by writing such things.
So you would. So let me ask you a question. Do you consider what I've written, just read out to you, sacrilegious?
Not really. Not from a young person. You're just talking about what was going through your mind, and it's actually quite good to hear because you know, I often wonder what young children are taught in convent schools, and I'm thinking, my goodness, you know, it's nice to know what they learn. It's also nice to know what they're thinking about the stuff they're being taught. So I think it's quite enlightening.
You know, I sort of thought that way as I was writing it.
Mm.
I mean, you know, writing something like that really is a creative process, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you sort of sit down with nothing in your head except this idea,
which
starts off about this big and then expands.
Mm.
Well, it's too big for the
but
page.
But these are all... Do you keep a diary when you were young? Did you write down your thoughts? Or is this all from memory?
Memory.
Wow, that's pretty good memory.
My memory... Look, I'll tell you what. You know, my memory of earlier this afternoon is... But my memory of when I was 5 years old is very good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can remember... When I was 8 years old, I was being... So the nun who taught me first... She was actually Sister Kirk, was her name.
Yeah.
And so then I moved on to an older class, and it was Sister Egan, and Sister Egan was a bit of a harridan, you know.
Well, Dennis, Sister Kirk, sorry to stop you. My phone's going to die. I didn't realise that it was so flat. I'm just going to quickly put it on the charger before I lose contact. Just
all right.
Bear with me. I'll just hold it there. Don't move. And I will just quickly go and do that right now before I lose you.
Don't take any notice of me.
You can just have a little chit-chat with your... Oh, it's good, you're getting some eggs.
Hard-boiled eggs. You know, what a great invention. It makes you wonder how bloody Chuck figured out how to put that nice yellow stuff inside that white stuff. Must have been good.
All right. Okay. I'll just unmute Skype. Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, I had to just quickly put my phone on the charger. Otherwise, this whole call would have been a waste of time. Yeah, so that's very interesting. So you remembered all that. And how long did it take you to write this book, Dennis?
Oh, look, it started off as a book that I called The Clandestine Text.
Okay.
And the Clandestine Text is that bit there.
Hmm.
In the middle.
And what does that mean, the clandestine? Are you referring to some text?
The story as I basically wrote it was that there were these texts where all of this truth and business about religion and nuns and preservation of the bloodline had been written down and kept, and they'd all been hidden. And so that's why they were called clandestine texts. And I can't even remember all of it, but it's all there.
Mm.
And so what I did, I mean, it's a bloody lot of stuff to remember, And so what I did was I enjoyed writing it. Look, I write for recreation.
Really?
You know, I just write for recreation and love it.
Well, then you've got to do it, don't you? You've got to just keep writing if you love it.
Yeah. And it was like being a sculptor. You know, when I was a sculptor, I would sit down. I mean, I did this sculpture you would have seen pictures of the two principal dancers from the New Zealand Ballet Company.
Yes, I've seen that. Fantastic.
And it's a body and portrait of those two people.
Mm.
And, you know, and I don't say portrait lightly. Look, I sat down with the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Rob Muldoon, and I did the first and only portrait I've ever done.
Mm.
I did his portrait in clay, life size, and we televised it.
Fantastic, that was.
And I'm completely confident that I could do it because I'd done it sort of. But I've never done another bloody likeness since. There's something about all that drives you that I can't quite put my finger on because I was driven to do this sculpture of Rob Muldoon, so I did it.
Mm.
And same with that with those two ballet dancers, you know. It is a body and facial portrait of those two people. And I spent a lot of time with them talking about the pose and what the feeling that I was wanted to get.
Yeah.
And I measured them all and, you know, made these bloody plans and they must have thought I was nuts to begin with. But, you know, then when I sort of walked back in with a semi-finished one and said, I just want to sort of check it, and I put it there, and then they did the same dance. Because the thing about ballet, you know, that I figured out, ballet is going, dance, 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 pose.
Yes, yes. Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Dance, 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 pose again.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
I never thought about it, but that's exactly what they do.
And so when I was watching them, I could kind of see that. And so, because I spent a lot of time just watching these two people in the same, just them and me in a room and them dancing.
Mm.
It's a kind of a unique thing to do. Eh?
that video you did of Milton Smirk on YouTube. Oh, there's... I just found a response that you did to Fire and Fury propaganda video. Oh, that's good. I'll have to look at that. I haven't seen that. I can't find that one on Muldoon. Did you do it on Milton Smirk or did you do it on the Homestead, whatever it was called?
Milton Smirk.
Yeah.
Somebody else said that the other day. I better go and have a look because obviously I've got a copy of it here.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing about that is that the TVNZ probably consider that they had the copyright on that.
They might do too, yeah. Why can't I see your video? Milton Smirk YouTube. I'll have a look and see if I can find it.
I'll just go and put it up again.
I got you. Okay, so I'm there. I'll just try and find Muldoon. Should be here. Oh, excuse me. Must have been something I had for lunch. What did I have for lunch?
Maybe it was my egg.
Yeah. Okay. You've got to hit video, don't you, to find things on this. Oh, look at you smashing up a warrior. Look at that.
Oh, that's still there.
Yeah, that's still there. Oh, so people can go to Milton Smirk Facebook page. Milton Smirk, it's all one word. And you can see, you can click on that and you can watch some of Dennis's videos are very interesting. My son's 24 and he quite liked your cooking one, Problems of Political Division in New Zealand. Was that the one? Or when you got the takeaways, you got Kentucky Fried Chicken and then you came home and then you show people how terrible it was and how you can go and buy a couple of cheap chooks from the supermarket and turn it into a really good meal. Because that's you used to be a caterer within your business, didn't you, in your homestead yeah. tenancy. So there's two YouTube channels you've got. The Homestead Tenancy and Milton Smirk. And I'd recommend people get there and have a watch some of those videos. They're very interesting. That's the one, KFC, or for $13.50, two whole chooks. KFC for $13.50 or two whole chooks for $17. Well, I'd go for the latter. That's had a few views. I can't find, it must be on the Homestead Tenancy. Because it's not there. No. I'll have a look.
There's another one that I did about God and an orange. And
yeah.
An orange and God and something else.
Homestead tenancy. There you go. Okay, so I'll click on that. Homestead tenancy.
And I was not interested in pottery, but I did.
Oh, there's your statue. Look at that.
Because I've been to.
I'll mute that. But look at that statue. Can people see that statue?
No.
No. Here they are. They can now. Look at that. That's you. And you did that statue. Oh, you can't see it. Sorry, Dennis. I'll just share that with you. Ka-chink. Ka-chink. There we go. Now, look at that. That's you, isn't it?
Oh, the one in the foreground?
Yeah. You did that, didn't you? The naked woman?
That was the first sculpture I ever did.
Right.
Number one.
Fantastic.
Naked woman.
Let me go back and see if I can find Muldoon, because I'm sure he's... There he is. There he is. This is a documentary. This was a great documentary. Shall we play that?
I haven't seen it for a long time.
It's 23 minutes. It's probably a bit long. I could play it at the end of this if you like. Oh, I could play it now. Why not? Shall we play that video? Let's play that. Okay, here we go.
Personally, you know that this is bringing the public under the control room, right?
Sculptor Dennis Hall working on a bust of Robert Muldoon that'll take 6 sittings. During these, the PM can talk freely about politics and being Minister of Finance.
I think it just comes, you know, you can't be a Minister of Finance without people feeling that...
Dennis, can you mute yourself?
Pretty hard.
Mute, yep.
Well, and I'll turn him up.
Minister of Finance, Harry Lake. He couldn't say no to anybody. He was a lovely fella. And so he always used to say either yes or maybe. And he was the nicest fellow that ever was. But he's too gentle to be Minister of Finance, really. He doesn't say a lot of no's. You say no first. And then
hang on a sec. I've just got to try and turn him up. He's a bit quiet.
Doesn't that bother you?
Well, when people have got no feelings about a politician, he's done, finished, isn't he? Yeah. He's not there any longer. Same with anybody in the public eye, isn't it? You know, you can take a pop singer. You say, what about so-and-so? Who's he? Never heard of him. Finished. Done. Isn't he?
Sometimes on television you seem like the headmaster.
I am the headmaster.
You are the headmaster.
Well, no, but I think what you're looking at in television is... a magnified image, because if you're in a room, you can see the whole room. But if you're in, if you're watching television, you just see that screen. And so if you put a face on the screen, everything's magnified and all the attention's on the face. And so...
Dennis, you can unmute yourself and...
television.
I'll stop that now, because that goes on for a long while. We'll get... people can...
They can find it. They can go find it if they want.
Yeah, they can find it. Yeah, yeah. And so that's good. They'll find that on the Homestead Tenancy. That's on YouTube. And there's all sorts of very interesting things on there, isn't there, on that one?
I can't remember.
Oh, no, it's fascinating. You can't remember. Oh, that's a shame. You've got one on... let me just find it. You've got one on it's all about the tenancy for 23 years, wasn't it? From 1999, was it? No, from 1976 to 1999.
Yeah, I sort of decided that I wanted to tell. The thing about my time at the homestead, if we can talk about that. I mean, we just bought we paid $65,000 for a lease on the homestead.
Yeah.
And it was a peppercorn lease.
Yeah.
And $65,000 back then would have bought 3 houses in Wellington.
Right.
1976, can't have a look. 65 grand's a lot of money.
I'll say.
And, you know, we got, and the Hawke's Bay community treated us like crap. They just did. And we went over to, you know, to give you an example. Do you want to talk about this?
Well, probably we should talk about that another day. And we have actually done a video on that. But it would be good to talk about that again. But now we're going off, and I didn't want to do that because we were really just wanted to focus on the well-intentioned sinner and what you learn in the Catholic Church is very, very interesting to me, for me, fascinating. It's given me a whole new light on why Catholics think the way they think, actually.
All I did was sit down and write down what I sort of experienced. And I did it as writing as an adult about something that happened when I was a child, you know.
Yeah.
But to be fair to the nuns, they spoiled me a bit. And the reason they spoiled me a bit is because of what I could do with plasticine.
Yes.
And I just, I'd have a ball of plasticine in my pocket. And if I felt like I was a bit offside with Sister Kirk or Miss Lattery or whatever, I just knocked them up a quick baby Jesus.
Just for a bit of fun. I'm not sure, yeah. But I think our studio program is frozen because it just seems to be frozen. I don't know what it's going to come out like, but it doesn't look right. So anyway, at least they can hear us anyway. So we're talking with we're speaking with Dennis Hall. He's the author of A Well-Intentioned Sinner. It took him 4 years to write. You finished it about four. No, how long? Sorry, how long? You finished it 4 years ago. How long did it take you to write it again?
Yeah, probably about the same.
About the same. 4 years. And it's kind of the idea is sort of based on the Holy Blood, Holy Grail. The book was written by Michael Page and Richard Lee and somebody Lincoln, and it's about
Henry.
And so it's about for those who haven't read it, it's about the theory that Jesus didn't die on the cross. Perhaps he was revived, or perhaps someone went up and took his place. And he actually went on to and married Mary Magdalene, and he sired her children. And those children, the bloodline of those children, are alive today. And that is actually quite detrimental to the Christian faith, if it's true. And it always makes me think that, because the Bible talks about an Antichrist coming, and I wonder if he will say that he is the descendant of Jesus Christ, that he comes from that bloodline. And because it says in the last book of the Bible that he actually makes himself out to be God, and he does actually enter into the temple and set up an image that's called the abomination of desolation. And Daniel spoke about it in the Old Testament, and Jesus also spoke about it as well when he went into the temple and he read. When he was talking to the disciples, and he said, when you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, then the Jews have got to take off into the hills because bad things are coming. So it makes me think that perhaps the Antichrist, or the beast he's called, the man of sin, he may well use this theory for his entrance into the world, so that he can actually convince people to worship him as God, because that's what he actually does, the Bible says. But he's actually the devil. The devil is in him. So, yes, it's interesting though, isn't it?
Well, the nuns taught us about the Antichrist and stuff. They were very afraid of the Antichrist.
They would be shocked to hear you talk about the Holy Blood. They would probably be quite offended by that book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Wouldn't they?
Could be.
Yeah.
But I did think that the way I saw Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and also there's the issue of the Da Vinci Code and being sued for plagiarism. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the thing about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, it was put forward, it was marketed as a book which re-examined the history of Jesus Christ and Christianity.
Yeah.
I would have. And so it was a scholarly thing. It wasn't a story. And so as a scholarly sort of tome, I would have thought that they would have expected people to extrapolate from it, because that's what people do with history, right?
Yes.
So it was offered as history. But if you stop and think about what that all means, so along came the Da Vinci Code. And so I reckon that Bajan and co. went along and they knocked on Dan Brown's door.
Mm.
Said, "Oi, Dan, how about we sue you?" And Dan
Brown said, to get a bit more publicity.
What do you mean? Why would you do that? Because we'll sell millions of copies of both books.
Yeah, okay? That's not a bad idea. So, I never thought of that.
And so then Dan would have said, "Oh, okay, right, we'll get into that. As soon as it starts to look tricky,
yeah,
we'll just withdraw it." And bingo, we would have sold another sort of 5 million copies of each book.
Yep.
But just as soon as I saw that court case, the words, I thought to myself, I know what's going to happen here. Everybody's going to go out and buy those books again. And as soon as that sale sort of splurge is well underway, they'll pull it. They'll pull the case. And they did.
Wow. That's incredible.
It cost them nothing for global publicity.
Mm. Yeah, that's not a bad. That's quite clever. But what about all the lawyers that were working on it? Or do you think that they, because we never really saw any court cases, did we? So maybe that was all just fictional.
Could have been all just talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, that's fascinating. And so you got the idea from what you'd learnt at the convent school between ages 6 and 7 in 1956 6 and 11 years old, from 46 to 1951. Brilliant. They were the best. They were some of the best times in New Zealand. We had no debt. Anyway, I'll talk about that later. And also the Holy Blood, Holy Grails. And then you put your book, which is a fantasy book, right? Isn't it?
Mm.
Would it come under fantasy or fiction anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a few things that come out of experience.
Yeah.
But none of it is true.
Yeah, yeah, right. So it's kind of a fantasy fiction book. And, you better do a movie.
I think I do think, while I was writing it, I did think it would make a great movie.
Yeah.
And, but it's sort of, and of course we have to say that we're talking about a book that is only published on Amazon as an e-book.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was, I'm a cheerless sort of character.
Mm.
And I just decided, I've done all these bloody sculptures, and I'm in New Zealand doing them, right? And I sort of know, for example, that the Marlene Dietrich that I did, it's in 1,200 homes.
Mm.
When the Christchurch earthquake happened, I got 25 of them back that had been damaged to be repaired. And the repair cost was around about $2,500 each.
Oh, that's good income.
And the windfall for me,
yeah.
The insurance companies paid for it.
Yep.
But, I just charged my time out at $50 an hour, which I'm entitled to do.
Absolutely.
Would have been cheaper to make a whole lot of new ones.
Yeah.
But the thing about that, what was the point I was trying to make? The thing about that was that, what was the question? See, this is what's wrong with my brain, Grant.
Well, I think you're doing extremely well.
My brain just lets go of the beginning of the question, and the question came from the
you were talking about your sculpting, and about how you were here in New Zealand being a sculptor, and how blimmin' impossible it is to be famous because of
and they're here in New Zealand.
Yeah.
When I wrote this book, I've never taken this to a New Zealand publisher.
Well, why didn't
you? Never, wouldn't even go near them.
Why not?
I don't want it to be published in New Zealand.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, now you've got it on Amazon. That's good.
That's global. And so the thing about the sculptures is I was stuck in New Zealand with them when I should have been in the United States.
Carry on. Yeah.
You're going to share
it? No, you carry on. You wanted it to be published in the United States.
Yes, because that's where the market is.
Yeah.
New Zealand's not a market. New Zealand's a suburb of bloody Los Angeles. In fact, it's probably a suburb of somewhere smaller.
Yeah.
It's not. And I'm sorry to say that, New Zealand, but yeah. If I'd been selling those sculptures in America, I'd have been a multimillionaire. But well, I wasn't.
Have a look. Who's that guy?
This guy here.
Yeah,
with
who's
the glasses.
That? The guy with the glasses.
Me. That's me.
That's you.
Yeah. And, I mean, have you ever heard of anybody? Look, you know, it sounds like boasting, but I mean, I've got this God-given talent for sculpture.
You sure right? have.
And I could sit down in front of the front.
And interviewing at the same time. I mean, look, you're interviewing this dude.
But, you know, I mean, I had a good attitude towards him. I was mowing the lawn at the homestead.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story. And I was thinking about these two ladies that come and spent some time with me the day before. Old farmers' wives they were. You know, all they're old ladies, but women are lovely.
You know,
you love
women,
don't gladly
you?
Spend time with old ladies. They're lovely. And so, you know, you talk with them and they sort of they'll say all kinds of things to you. But I went into the studio and I got two big blobs of mud, you know, and I stuck them on the table and I made a little likeness of each of them while we were drinking sherry. And I'd never done that before, you know. It was just a quick likeness. It was like a cartoon, right? It was clear which one was which.
Yeah.
And then and the next day I'm driving up and down the front lawn mowing the lawn and I'm thinking about Muldoon because, you know, he was the man.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, you know, what a good idea it would be for me to ring up Muldoon and tell him I'll make a sculpture of him and we'll televise it and him and I can have a non-confrontational, which is the word I used, conversation about stuff. And so it seemed like a good idea. I'd never done a bloody proper portrait before, ever.
See, that's unbelievable that you'd never done it. And here you are. Not only are you doing something you've never really done before in front of the Prime Minister of New Zealand... who was a very, you know, he's a gruff man. I mean, you've got to have your act together to talk to him.
Yeah, and the TV audience.
Were you confident you could get through this and do it?
Oh, absolutely.
But you've never done it before.
I was more confident than he was.
And not only that, you were interviewing him. You drew him out. It was one of the most relaxed interviews. You really drew him out, and we saw a Muldoon that was... He was clearly interested in your thoughts, and you were clearly interested in him. And it's the best interview I've seen of Muldoon, because he's normally very on the offensive and very gruff because people are trying to trip him up all the time. But this was a great interview. And it's such a shame that they didn't do the whole thing. 23 minutes.
It was a mad idea. You've got to follow mad ideas sometimes.
It's a great idea.
I just went inside and wound up the phone.
Yeah,
and I got Parliament, and then I said I want to talk to Mr. Muldoon. Always polite.
And you talked
to Mr. Muldoon's secretary.
Yeah,
and the secretary, and I said to him, I think it was a hair, and I said, look, my name's Dennis Hall. I'm a sculptor, and I said I reckon I could make a bust of Rob Muldoon, and we could televise that, and it would take about six sittings, and we could televise it, and it would give him. You know, an extended period to have a conversation with somebody that was non-confrontational.
Absolutely brilliant.
And she said, oh, hang on a minute. And moments later, Muldoon came on the phone. And he said, what's all this about? And so I gave him the same little spiel. And he said, what did TV did say? And I said, don't know, I haven't talked to them yet. And he said, call me back when you have.
Did he expect? Do you think he expected them to agree to it, or do you think he expected them to turn you down?
Tell you how long it took them to agree. Not even 30 seconds.
They said yes, great.
I rung up this, you know, really fast. I rung up. There was this guy Tony Hiles who used to produce or
Tony Hiles. Yep, I know the name.
A lot of stuff.
Yep.
And I went inside, rang on the old wind up phone, got them and. In fact, immediately after I hung up with Muldoon, I think, and told them the same thing. And they said, what does the Prime Minister say? And I said, he said exactly the same as you. What does TVNZ say? And they said, straight away, we'll do it.
Right. And how long after that phone call did you actually sit down in front of Muldoon and do the first interview and start working on this bust?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Well, that's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. We're speaking with author.
Very proud of it. It's an extraordinary thing to do. And you know, and I've never seen anybody ever do that anywhere in the world that I know of. Because, you know, most people would struggle to make a likeness. They just would.
Yep. Now, for those of you that have just dropped in, we're speaking with Dennis Hall. Dennis is the author of Well-Intentioned Sinner. You can get that on Amazon for $14.95. Is that US dollars? Probably is. $14.95. Dennis is also a sculptor, and there is, that's his bust you can see there of Sir Rob Muldoon when he was Prime Minister of New Zealand right up until 1983. And this was done just before the election, wasn't it, this one? Just before the election.
Yeah,
and
yes, it was. But, yeah. You know, they said to me when they, you know, I went in to, and Roger Gascoigne, people remember him.
Yes, Roger Gascoigne, yeah.
No, he was in Radio Windy, because I did a thing on Radio Windy as
Gascoigne,
well.
Gascoigne, yeah.
He was Brian Edwards, that was a fluke.
Brian, and no relation to me.
No, the guy on, the person I talked to at TV1 said, oh, somebody got me in the hallway. One day when I was in there, and he said, you know, they'll never invite you back. And
after doing that sculpture?
Yeah.
Sculpture.
And I said, why not? And they said, they won't like the fact that you allowed Muldoon to talk.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's the end of you. But they said they can't not show it. Because it's probably the best interview he ever did.
Showed Muldoon in a very positive light, and the leftists, which were fighting to take the New Zealand, you know, the Rogernomics and all that, they and the media were fully on their side. They would not have wanted this to really go out, would they? It's amazing that it went out.
But that's the other thing that they did. It didn't go out till after the election.
Yes, so they manipulated the result, because this would have been, this would have probably put Rob Muldoon, he would have won the election if they'd seen this.
That's what they said.
Yep.
That's what they said.
Yep, that's how fickle we are. But, you know, forget about policies.
They were really straightforward about it. They just said, I said, when are you going to show it? And they said, after the election. And I said, why not before? And they said, because it would give them an advantage.
Well, so it should.
Well, it's just honest.
I mean, this is what today people have got YouTube, so they can, and you know, video they can do. They got Facebook and Twitter and all those others. Look at you there; you look pretty fit. And they could see that you can do that. So, you know, Rob Muldoon today, he would have made full use of the television and the radio, and his own, you know, YouTube and stuff like that. And he wouldn't have needed the media. Trump didn't need the media because they had a very strong Twitter presence and a Facebook presence and even a YouTube presence, and it wasn't until he won the election that they actually cut him off, because that's what helped him win the election, was that social media. And I think it was his son-in-law that helped there. He took charge of that, so they won. But so Trump, I don't think Trump could have won the election if it was just left to the mainstream media. They would have, because they were just painting him as a really bad person. And the power of social media. And that's why they're censoring it today. That's why Liberty NZ has kicked off Facebook. Liberty NZ has kicked off YouTube. And so, you know, we have to go on these smaller ones now. So it's just the way it is. You have to have your own channel. And because it's very hard, you've really got to be on YouTube. And they won't let us. They took down my whole site. I think I had quite a few thousand followers even back then, but it's all gone now.
It's terrible, eh?
So you've got to start all over again.
Yeah.
Which is why we need to come together. Media, independent media need to come together, and that's what we're planning.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Well, that's very, very interesting. That was well done. And so if people want to see that, they can, by going, it's called Dennis Hall Sculpting Rob Muldoon on national television. I think we only had TV1. I don't even think we had TV2 in 83, did we? Might have had TV2.
I can't remember.
I can't remember either. And they can see that on not Milton Smirk. Milton Smirk's a good one on YouTube, but also I'm surprised you've still got the channel. And the other one is The Homestead Tenancy. Go to YouTube and see Milton Smirk. Now, while I've got people here, Dennis Hall, I should say, while I've got people here, I'm just going to reach over, excuse me, and I'm just going to get some products here. I had the product placement, but it didn't work very well. My camera didn't pick them up. So we've got the Kokovo. So I want to introduce people to some of these products here. I don't know if you can see them. I can't get, for some reason, Skype seems to flip them all around the other way, but this is called Kokovo. And as a lovely chap I met last week, Kokovo, that's his business. He's in Whangarei. Neville Montefiore, he's the director and managing director, I should say, general manager. And they call him Monty. And these are some of his products. This one is like an olive oil infused. It's raw extra virgin cold pressed coconut and avocado with chili and lime. And you can cook with that. That's delicious. This one here is garlic salt. These are some of the things that Kokovo put out, garlic salt. And then those are their brand. And here we've got, look, you can't see it, but it says bull dust. And that's a rub. This is the beef one, and there's also a pork one as well. And this is my favourite. Look, I've only had this not less than a week, this bottle, and I've used almost all of it. This is called Smoky Oil. And it's, wow, it just absolutely fabulous. You can't read the writing. I'll have to figure out how to get it around the right way. But so that's Kokovo, and they're in Port Road in Whangarei. And he's sponsoring the show today. He's sponsoring the podcast. He doesn't realize it yet, but he is, because he's a great guy, Monty. And so I'm going to buy all my stuff. And you know, you can go in there and you can pay cash if you want to, and he gives you a bit of a discount for being such a nice, you know, because it's always good to have a bit of cash in your pocket, isn't it? So he likes cash, but he always pays his taxes. There we are. And I bought a couple of $100 worth of just what do you call it, stuff like this that you put put on your beef.
Merchandising. Put on your beef, it's a sauce.
It's a sauce. Well, it's not really a sauce. I've got some sauces as well, but they're in the fridge, and I don't think this will reach to the fridge. So you can see that I live in a tiny house, can't you? That's my tiny house. See, there we are. There's my kettle and my dishwasher. I've got a little dishwasher.
Actually, it hadn't occurred to me that it was a small house.
Yeah, it's my tiny house. It's 8 meters long by 3 meters wide, and it's double story. And
8 meters,
yeah,
3 meters wide.
Eight by three. It's a bit of a shambles, but it's my home. And I built it about 6 years ago, but I haven't lived in it all the time. I've got it out at the farm, and when I'm here, this is where I stay. And then quite often I'll stay in town though. It just depends. But right now, at the moment, I've got a few things happening on the farm, and I've really got to be here all the time, keep an eye on these animals, especially in the summer, because the troughs can dry out, and they'll drink, you know, 50 cows, 50, 60 cows can drink a trough dry in no time at all. And, you know, if they can break it, and they love fiddling with it. They like fiddling with the ball and the ball cock, you know, in the trough, and they break them all the time. So I've got to be here. So, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Dennis. This has been absolutely marvellous. So Milton Smirk and also The Homestead Tenancy on YouTube. And you can hear and watch Dennis having a lot of fun talking about things that are really important for our country, talking about the Three Waters, talking about the Maorification of New Zealand, talking about this crazy government we've got that we need to get out, and whether the new government that coming up, which it looks like is going to be a national act government, and that I think will be not much better than what we've got. If you want to buy Dennis's book, you need to go to Amazon. It is A Well-Intentioned Sinner, published by Dennis Hall, and it's $14.95 on Amazon, and you can probably get it on Kindle as well. I don't know, but normally you can, can't you? Buy that on
not
Kindle.
Sure. No.
Yeah, and if anything happens that they can't get it on Kindle and they don't want to get a full book, and then they can send you $20, make it 30, in the post, and you can send them a Word document of it. Have you got hard copies there?
hard copies.
Yeah.
No, look, I only had 25. Like, look, these books cost me $70 each.
Good grief.
And that was printed, yeah. That's all on really good paper.
That's beautiful. But, you know, that's a lot of money when you do a small print run. How many did you print? Probably only, what, 50 or something or less? Oh, wow, that'd be a lot of money. 25. That's a big investment. 25.
Yeah. Well, huge they were investment. All gone within a... I gave a lot of them away. I sort of go into friends' houses now and I see them on the bookshelf and I say, you read it yet? And they say, oh, no, but we'll get around to it.
Oh, that's a shame they don't read it. John Ansell's written a book. He's written a couple of books of poetry too. He gave me one, and I've got it somewhere. I must have left it in the city house. I can't find it. I've got to dig that out because it's quite interesting. So, had a great meeting with John Ansell last night. We're up to some more mischief. So watch this space. We hope to bring you something interesting. Can't really talk too much about
John
it.
It's all a bit quiet. Special but, kind of character.
All right, well, that's you. So thank you very much, Dennis. We'll let you go, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, mate.
Okay, bye now. Cool.